Good evening, and I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Biden abroad. During a trip to Asia, the president says the U.S. military would defend Taiwan if China attacked. How the remarks are overshadowing a new trade pact meant to counter China's influence in the region. Then, vote 2022. Georgia Republicans head to the polls in a heated primary animated by former President Trump's lies about the 2020 election.
There is a fight for the future of the Republican Party in Georgia. Donald Trump is still a very popular figure within Georgia Republicans, but what that popularity means is going to be on the ballot.
And another disease. Multiple countries record cases of the highly contagious monkeypox virus as nations still struggle to contain COVID-19. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. President Biden has pledged that the U.S. will intervene militarily if China invades Taiwan. He said the need to protect the island was, quote, even stronger after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. While in Tokyo, the president also launched a new trade deal with 12 Indo-Pacific nations. We'll have more on all this right after the news summary. Pfizer says three small doses of its COVID-19 vaccine offer strong protection to children under five. The company plans to share its data with U.S. regulators later this week. Meanwhile, the U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, warned of burnout and staffing shortages among healthcare workers after more than 2 years fighting COVID.
If we fail to act to address health worker burnout, we will place our nation's health at increasing risk. Already, one in five physicians and two in five nurses say they intend to leave their practice altogether. Those are extraordinary and disturbing numbers.
Murthy also released a new report predicting a shortage of 3 million essential low-wage health workers in the next 5 years. The first Russian soldier to be tried for war crimes in Ukraine was sentenced to life in prison today. The 21-year-old pleaded guilty to shooting a 62-year-old Ukrainian civilian in the head. His attorney said they plan to appeal. Meanwhile, in a video address to the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky urged countries to ramp up their sanctions against the Kremlin.
What should the sanctions be like? Maximal, so that Russia or any other potential aggressor that might want to brutally attack a neighbor would know straight away what the consequences are.
Also today, a veteran Russian diplomat at the United Nations office in Geneva resigned in opposition to the war in Ukraine. In a letter, he said he had never been so ashamed of his country as he was on the day Russia invaded. The number of refugees around the world has crossed the 100 million mark for the first time ever. That's according to the UN's Refugee Agency. It attributed the staggering milestone to the war in Ukraine and other deadly conflicts in places like Afghanistan and Ethiopia. It estimated the Ukraine war has forced more than 6 million people to flee the country and displaced another 8 million more inside Ukraine. Pre-monsoon floods in India and Bangladesh have killed at least 24 people in recent weeks and displaced at least 90,000 others. India's northeastern Assam state has seen some of the worst of it. Entire villages are inundated, forcing many to build makeshift shelters. Others were left stranded due to damaged roads.
We don't have any idea how we will survive. We're just waiting for the government to take some action and have a look at our situations. We have nothing to eat or drink, and my children are starving now.
Both India and Bangladesh are prone to frequent flooding, made worse by extreme weather conditions from climate change. The World Health Organization said today that the monkeypox outbreak detected in a dozen countries may be a random event. It believes the spread may have been linked to sexual behavior at recent rave dance parties in Spain and Belgium. Until now, there haven't been widespread outbreaks of the viral disease outside Africa.
It is spreading currently, and once again, we are haunted by the specter of a new epidemic. This reminds us how much today's world is more and more vulnerable and interconnected.
So far, there's only been one confirmed monkeypox case in the U.S. in Massachusetts. But there are at least four other probable cases, one in New York, one in Florida, and two in Utah. We'll have more on this later in the program. The U.S. Supreme Court today made it harder for prisoners to win release by arguing that they had ineffective counsel in state court. The 6-3 ruling was a defeat for two Arizona death row inmates who said their state lawyers failed to provide an adequate defense. Writing for the majority, Justice Clarence Thomas said federal courts can only consider evidence already presented in the state court record. And stocks rallied on Wall Street today after suffering seven straight weeks of losses. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 618 points to close at 31,880. The Nasdaq rose 180 points, and the S&P 500 added 72. Still to come on the NewsHour, Tamara Keith and Amy Walter break down what's at stake in Georgia's Republican primary. Civilians desperately seek shelter as Russia tries to expand its military gains in southern Ukraine. A new report details widespread cover-ups of sexual abuse among Southern Baptist church leaders, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
President Biden's statement that the United States would defend Taiwan from an attack triggered a sharp response from China. It also raises questions about whether the president is changing U.S. policy and making a new security commitment to Taiwan. Nick Schifrin has the story.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Prime Minister of Japan and the President of the United States.
In Tokyo State Palace today, a meeting of two historic allies and a president willing to confront Beijing on its most sensitive subject.
Are you willing to get involved militarily to defend Taiwan if it comes to that?
Yes.
You are?
That's a commitment we made.
Today's remarks repeat what President Biden said last October.
So are you saying that the United States would come to Taiwan's defense if China attacked?
Yes, we have a commitment to do that.
That's not official U.S. policy. The Taiwan Relations Act obligates the U.S. to enable Taiwan to maintain a sufficient self-defense capability and maintain the capacity of the U.S. to resist any resort to force. But despite U.S. weapon sales to Taiwan, the U.S. has been ambiguous whether it would intervene militarily. And the U.S. acknowledges that all Chinese on both sides of the Taiwan Strait maintain that there is one China and Taiwan is a part of China, as Biden reiterated today.
We agree with a one China policy. We signed on to it and all the attendant agreements made from there. But the idea that it could be taken by force will dislocate the entire region and be another action similar to what happened in Ukraine. And so it's a burden that is even stronger.
China views Taiwan as a breakaway province and vows reunification. Beijing increasingly threatens Taiwan militarily, including flying 14 warplanes into the island's self-identified air defense zone just last week. Today, Beijing heard President Biden's commitment and responded with anger.
China expressed strong dissatisfaction and resolute opposition to the U.S. remarks. Taiwan is an inalienable part of Chinese territory.
President Biden's primary message today, a new regional trade framework. 12 countries signed on to the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework that aims to strengthen supply chains, expand clean energy, and crack down on corruption. But it does not go as far as the 2016 Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, which then-President Trump abandoned in his first week in office, and U.S. allies still prefer.
Japan hopes to see the United States return to the TPP from a strategic perspective.
For more on all this, we turn to Ivan Kanapathy. He served as director for China, Taiwan, and Mongolia on the National Security Council staff during the Trump administration. He also served in the U.S. liaison office in Taiwan, known as the American Institute in Taiwan, where he was a military advisor to the Taiwanese government. He's now with Beacon Global Strategies, an international consulting firm. Ivan Kanapathy, welcome to the NewsHour. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Nick. Good to be here.
It has been three times now that President Biden has reiterated this policy, and three times he or the White House has walked it back. So, is it a change in policy?
So, you know, it's not a formal change in what you might call a declaratory policy. You know, it's not an executive order or formal declaration. I think it's an indication of what the president thinks today, or when he says it, what he would do if Taiwan were attacked. And frankly, that decision is his to make. And so in that sense, representing the United States, that's what he's letting the world know. And there's probably some good reasons for that.
How has Taiwan's thinking about how it would defend itself changed just in the last few months as we've seen Ukraine defend itself from Russia?
So I think in Taiwan, there's been a little bit of an awakening. I think it's actually happened over a few years' time. Some of the events in Hong Kong, for example, over the last couple of years have driven a little bit more of a sense of urgency in Taiwan. And I think the example of Ukraine has only furthered that.
And so I spoke to a senior State Department official who confirmed that the State Department has resisted some of Taiwan's requests for big ticket items, things like helicopters. And the U.S. is now pushing Taiwan to buy things, frankly, that we've heard about for the last few months in Ukraine, things like Stingers, things like Javelins. Why are those smaller items more important?
Well, I think from a U.S. government standpoint, we're looking, the belief is that Taiwan maybe has underinvested in those island defense capabilities. And some of those larger platforms, while maybe more important for some more longer term purposes, they are, as you would expect, quite expensive, and therefore not the most cost-effective way to provide deterrence.
And nor perhaps the best way to defend the island militarily, right?
That's right, yeah. Some of those capabilities aren't gonna just give you the bang for buck, and as we're seeing that in Ukraine, and this has been sort of a long-term back and forth, I would say, between the United States and Taiwan.
In Taipei, will President Biden's comments be reassuring, or are they looking at the fact that U.S. did not send any soldiers into Ukraine, and they're actually more worried about what could happen?
Well, if you look at the polling, Nick, recently, I think before Ukraine, this latest invasion, two out of three folks in Taiwan expected really the United States to come and defend militarily. That has dropped now to one out of three. In some ways, there's a silver lining to that because it creates, again, that sense of urgency in Taiwan and that realization that maybe they need to invest more in their own self-defense.
And bottom line, when you hear President Biden say these words again, when Beijing hears President Biden say these words again, there is a sense here in D.C., Beijing, Taipei, that things are changing, right? This is a significant policy moment for the U.S., right?
It's a significant policy moment, Nick, I think, in the sense that President Biden is, I think, reflecting the American people. I think in 2021 was the first time that a majority of Americans polled actually said that they would support sending U.S. troops in to defend Taiwan. And so in that sense, it is a signal of a shift.
Of U.S. commitment to the island.
Correct.
Let's talk about the economic framework that the president introduced today. How important is it that these other 12 countries join today, and especially India?
So I think India is the most significant. The administration's done a great job, I think, in the last few months getting these countries on board. You've got, I think, seven from the Southeast Asia region. You've got all U.S. allies from the region among these dozen countries. But the truth is, it's just sort of the beginning. This is just the launch, and it's not clear what of substance will be within the framework, but there's potential there, and it's a good diplomatic signal.
How much does this framework mean to these countries, given that the executive itself, the president himself, cannot offer things like market access without congressional approval?
Well, that's going to be a challenge for the executive, but there isn't really a desire to offer market approval from, frankly, Congress, i.e. the U.S., the United States democracy, as we see it. We've gone down many roads, I think, over years, if not decades, in that direction. And quite frankly, folks aren't too satisfied with the results. And so this takes things in a new direction and hopefully in a positive one. But I think it'll be years before we can really make that assessment.
Ivan Kanapathy, thank you very much.
Thanks, Nick.
recent primary elections in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and elsewhere have shown that former President Donald Trump still exerts strong influence on Republican voters. Tomorrow, his influence will once again be tested, this time at the polls in Georgia, a state President Biden narrowly won in 2020. William Brangham just returned from Georgia and has this report.
Early voting has been going on for weeks in Georgia, and while inflation and high gas prices are top of mind for many, another issue has also been thrust center stage.
Let me be very clear tonight. The election in 2020 was rigged and stolen.
In the Georgia governor's race, the popular Republican incumbent Brian Kemp is trying to fend off a challenge from former Senator David Perdue, whose main attack has been that Kemp should have reversed the last election because of unproven claims of fraud.
The only one lying here is you, and that is a fact.
Brian Kemp let us down. We can't let it happen again.
Former President Trump endorsed Perdue, hoping to unseat the governor who wouldn't echo his lies about the election.
I followed the law and I followed the Constitution.
There's a similar fight to unseat incumbent Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, who famously refused President Trump's request to, quote, find him 11,000 votes.
I only need 11,000 votes. Fellas, I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break.
Raffensperger is facing a primary from another Trump-endorsed election denier, Republican Congressman Jody Heiss.
I believe the election here in Georgia reeked with fraudulent activity.
So the question is this so-called big lie, the widely discredited notion that somehow the 2020 election was stolen from President Trump, is that theory going to resonate with voters 2 years later here in Georgia? We went to Woodstock, Georgia in Cherokee County, where Trump won nearly 70% of the vote, to ask Republicans that question.
I don't have a lot of trust in the elections themselves.
Real estate agent Mary Elizabeth Morris is convinced the last election was stolen.
I feel like they are looking at us like, oh, well, you're just so stupid you won't know that we committed these crimes. I mean, there's so much evidence, but nothing's being done.
Do you think that the last election was stolen?
I think in every election ever, there's been some hootie-doo going on.
Hootie-doo is the technical term for it?
It is in Woodstock. But I think now, with the scrutiny that it's under, I have more faith in this election than any in a while.
Former Major League Baseball scout Tim Osborne says all this conspiratorial talk of a rigged election is a distraction.
I would rather focus on the economy now and Ukraine now and things like that.
There is a fight for the future of the Republican Party in Georgia. You know, Donald Trump is still a very popular figure within Georgia Republicans, but what that popularity means is going to be on the ballot.
Stephen Fowler covers state politics for Georgia Public Broadcasting. A poll from earlier this year showed 3 out of 4 Georgia Republicans still believe there was widespread fraud in 2020.
For there to be a conspiracy to overturn the election or to rig the election would have to take an incredible number of Republicans colluding against their own party, and this is the most scrutinized election system and elections in the entire country. And still, for thousands and thousands and thousands of people, it's not enough.
The Associated Press analyzed every case of voter fraud in the 6 battleground states, including Georgia, that former President Trump contested. It found fewer than 475 cases, quote, a number that would have made no difference in the 2020 presidential election.
We have been there on Friday night wondering, how are we going to get through this?
After the 2020 election, Governor Brian Kemp signed a much criticized election law to roll back changes that were made during the pandemic, things like expanded ballot drop boxes and easier absentee mail-in voting. But he rejects the idea that the 2020 election was stolen or that he could have or should have changed the outcome.
Does it frustrate you that you have to keep litigating the last election?
No, it does not frustrate me being governor of Georgia. This is the greatest state in the country to live, work, and raise our families. I mean, people have their individual views. That's part of the primary process. I've been involved in those fights before.
Kemp's defense of the 2020 election seemingly hasn't hurt his campaign. He's currently well ahead in the polls, and many of his supporters welcome his move away from the conspiracy.
Well, I'm going to be very honest with you.
I don't think the election was stolen.
Holly Gardner is a retired school principal. She says she doesn't quite understand the grip Trump still has on so many in her party.
Like a cult that I don't want to be a part of. I don't understand it. I really don't. I can't imagine someone having that much influence on me as an American voter.
Shane Muma is the head of college Republicans at Vanderbilt University and a big Kemp supporter.
This is the man our party should support. And I think it's childish that the former president wants to derail his campaign based on that he doesn't support some lie and actually stood up for election integrity.
But those false allegations are not slowing down.
This is organized crime.
Do you have video evidence?
4 million minutes of surveillance video around the country.
A new documentary called 2000 Mules is out, claiming to have video and cell phone data proving so-called mules committed voter fraud in 2020. We talked with some voters, like Mike Mostowski, outside a screening of the film in Holly Springs, Georgia.
We've been looking for the smoking gun for a year now. And when this movie came out a week or two back, my wife and I came and watched it. And I said, game over.
But multiple news organizations, including the Washington Post, NPR, and the Associated Press, have debunked the film, saying it's wildly misleading, full of dubious claims, and that its supposed evidence is full of gaping holes. The Georgia Bureau of Investigation, after reviewing materials sent by the filmmakers, said a probe was not justified.
Brian Kemp sold us out and allowed radicals to steal the election.
Former Senator Perdue continues with his unfounded claims of fraud.
Senator, you have repeatedly said that the 2020 election was rigged and stolen.
Yep.
And why do you still believe that?
Because of the hard evidence. Why do you guys not look at the hard evidence?
At a meet and greet with supporters in Covington, Georgia, we asked if constantly spreading these baseless claims might make his own voters afraid to vote.
But half of the 350,000 Republicans who have voted in this primary so far in the first 2.5 weeks did not vote in 18. You make your own conjecture about what that is. These people are upset, and they're not going to go away.
But for the people who actually run elections in Georgia, combating this avalanche of lies and accusations has become a full-time job.
There are certain folks out there that I will never be able to convince of how this really works, even if I show them step by step. That's when it gets really frustrating.
You're going to fill this out first.
Joseph Kirk is the election supervisor of Bardo County, an area that former President Trump won by more than 50 points.
And then that gets plugged in here.
Kirk tries to educate voters as much as possible about how elections work and how secure the process is.
And then your initials right there.
But he says some of his poll workers, that's who's being trained here, have been threatened and harassed, and he's had to beef up security to protect them.
Violence against election officials should never happen. That's not a political issue, that's just a decency issue. And these are your neighbors, your friends, your community, people are volunteering their time to serve their country and facilitate this process.
Thank you, Georgia. Thank you very much.
This week's primary in Georgia will be another measure of just how much influence the former president and his lies about the election still have on Republican voters.
This election in Georgia has also revealed a high-profile disagreement between Donald Trump, who we saw endorsing David Perdue for governor, and his former Vice President Mike Pence, who is backing current Governor Brian Kemp and is holding a rally for him tonight. So let's dive into what's at stake in Georgia with our Politics Monday team. That's Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter and Tamara Keith of National Public Radio. Great to see you both. Great to be here. Amy, help me understand this. Pence is now making his most unambiguous break with President Trump, stumping for the governor that irritates Donald Trump more than any governor in America. But in the midst of this ongoing identity crisis for the GOP, does Pence move the needle in any way?
So I think Mike Pence looks at what's happening in Georgia right now and thinks, oh, well, maybe that's the path for me too. A governor, Brian Kemp, who stood up to claims by the president that the election was rigged, that he could just simply overturn it, says, no, I'm not doing it. The president threatens him. And right now it looks like Kemp's going to run away with this primary. Mike Pence says, gosh, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? he's told me I could do all these things, overturn the election. Obviously, I couldn't do those things. I'm going to present myself, much like Brian Kemp did, which is I'm a conservative candidate with a conservative record without the baggage that Donald Trump brings. I'm not going to talk about 2020. I'm going to talk about the future. We're not going to litigate the past. That's not where voters want us to go. Now, it's much more complicated when you get into a presidential contest with Donald Trump versus an incumbent governor that Donald Trump's trying to unseat. But it's clear that that's the pathway that he would like to make for himself.
I mean, that's Pence's strategy, Amy, but Tamara. We always get a bit of grief for talking about the former president a lot, but he does exert a serious gravitational pull in the GOP, and that's why he still has to be factored in all of these races.
Certainly. And even the candidates who are not openly saying that they have the support of Donald Trump and that they that the election results should be overturned, say, well, there are questions, that there are doubts about the election. So even the sort of mainstream conservative Republican candidates are saying just enough, playing just enough footsie with the big lie to not turn off Trump voters in a primary. So his presence is very real, and you have to look beyond just this one race. He's endorsed something like a dozen candidates in Georgia primaries. Now, many of them are completely unopposed. And
all the way down to the insurance commissioner he's even endorsed.
And he'll be able to declare that his candidates, he pulled them across the finish line, even though they were unopposed in some of these cases. He also has Herschel Walker, who is his chosen person for the Senate race. And there was really no ability of Republicans, other than Trump Republicans, there was no ability to pull anyone up with him. He is going to be the Republican nominee quite easily, even though there are a lot of Republicans in Georgia and elsewhere who have a lot of concerns about him as their nominee.
Amy, let's just say that once the midterms come and a certain number of these Republican candidates who support the idea of the big lie, let's say those candidates lose. Does that help break this fever within the GOP?
Well, I think so much of it is about the leadership, right? What's going to happen when there are contested elections? What are the leaders in those elections going to do, the candidates in those cases? Are they going to react the way Donald Trump did, say, well, that's the path for us? And I think we have a couple of examples showing that really, for the most part, we're not seeing that as becoming sort of part of the DNA or it's something that candidates are going to do after every election. There was talk after the California recall election that the Republican candidate there wasn't going to concede. He ended up conceding pretty quickly. More recently, in Pennsylvania, there's a Senate primary that has still not been called. There are about 1,000 votes separating two candidates. It is going down into legal process. We're talking about absentee ballots. We're talking about signatures, all the things we heard about during the 2020 election. Both the Republican candidates, though, are sticking with
let
the process work. Nobody's saying this has been legitimate and I'm just going to call myself the winner. No, this has been illegitimate. I'm calling myself the winner. Now, this is early times, but I think those are two pretty good examples to suggest that Donald Trump's way of doing things isn't going to necessarily be the way that candidates decide they're going to follow.
Tim, what do you think? Does it break the fever if a bunch of these candidates lose?
But there are a bunch of other candidates who are going to win. You have someone like Doug Mastriano in Pennsylvania, who is part of his stock and trade, and what made him a promising candidate for the Republicans is, and what got him Trump's endorsement is his really strong commitment to the big lie, the fact that he went on January 6th to Washington, D.C. and marched toward the Capitol, though he says he didn't go in or he didn't break the law. So you have candidates who are going to make it past the primary, who are going to be the party's nominee, who may or may not have Trump's backing, but absolutely support the idea of only taking the votes that you want or of only accepting the result that is the result that you like. I think that it's not settled yet whether there will be some candidates who simply say, I'm not accepting the result. There certainly are millions of Americans, Americans who went and saw that 2000 Mules movie in movie theaters, because it is in theaters. It isn't just in the corners of the internet. They got it into theaters. There are Americans who wholly believe that 2020 was stolen. And if you look at the ads that are running in states all over the country in these primaries, they are talking about how the election was stolen, how things were rigged. And it is just feeding upon itself so that millions of Americans believe that 2020 was rigged. And if somebody tells them in 2022 or 2024 that it was, they're primed to believe it.
I talked to a lot of Georgia voters coming out of that film, and they were convinced that this was prima facie evidence of fraud. And it's like we're living in two different ecosystems here. This whole argument about the big lie is what yielded January 6th to a large degree. We know Congress is going to be holding hearings about this. Some Democrats have promised on that committee that they have blockbuster testimony that they will reveal to the public. We don't know what that is, but let's just say that that does come to pass. Do you think that that searing day, albeit presented via a congressional hearing, similarly moves people? Is there anything at this point that people could see about January 6th that will change their opinion?
I do doubt that to be the case. I just think we've now, the political lines are pretty well set and they're pretty deep right now. To Tam's point, if you've already gone and seen a movie and you're convinced that that movie is right, there's nothing that is going to be shown in at a hearing, which Republicans are going to say was completely political and completely biased to work. The one thing I will say, though, as a tactic, right, for being a strong candidate in this election, if you're a Republican, the issue is inflation. The issue is economy. That's what voters across the board are saying is the most important thing to them. If they decide instead, these candidates, I'm going to focus on the 2020 election being rigged. I'm going to focus on Donald Trump and showing my loyalty to Donald Trump. Polling shows that that is a terrible decision, because independent voters overwhelmingly, just 24% of them say, yeah, we want a candidate, for a Republican candidate for Congress who's going to focus on the 2020 election. That's not what they're looking for. Republicans may be, but independent voters are not.
Tomorrow will certainly be a big test of how these races all unfolded. Right. Amy and Tam, so good to see you. Thank you both very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
As Russian forces battle for full control of southern Ukraine, small villages that dot the landscape have borne the brunt of the bombardment. John Ray of Independent Television News visited one town on the front line, just 2 miles from where Russian troops are dug in.
This is the rhythm of each and every day. It's how they mark time. In the town where the Russians measure their progress, in ruined homes and frayed mines. In this gloom, mental and literal, Ludmila and her friends have been living for 3 months without break.
Who asked the Russians to come here? What have they come to free us from? Our families? Our homes? From our lives?
Vera tells us she has nowhere else to hide.
How long can you stay?
Until it ends, she says. So for the foreseeable future, home is the basement of the town's hospital. No running water, no mains power, no way to care for patients in the dark, unless they can plug in this generator. And that too will require nerves of steel.
How are things in your hospital now? Do you have the medicine, power?
No, and we have no patients here at the moment.
You're used to that all day, all day, every day.
Huliapole is where the Russians were stopped in their tracks, but now its people are marooned in the firing line.
This is an unremarkable town whose great misfortune is to be so close to Russian lines. They are just 2 miles down the road here. And that means that almost every day for the past 3 months, it's come under attack.
Elena never imagined her mother's twilight years would be spent here, in the pitch black of a bunker. Katerina is deaf, but she can feel the bombs land. She remembers the Nazis here, Elena says, but she thinks the Russians are worse.
The Russians know what they're doing. It's just that they don't care very much about the consequences. This enormous crater was once a simple village home, and the family who lived here had even written "people" on the gate.
Humanity is missing wherever you look. And while the war has turned east, Ukraine cannot afford to neglect this long southern flank.
They have enough ammunition for war. They prepared for this war. They have enough of everything.
So it's you who needs more.
We need more. We didn't prepare.
In this one small town, 21 civilians have died in the daily shelling. It's a collective trauma. In the attack on the market, Jana lived, she says, only because a neighbor pushed her to the floor. She is clearly still in shock. The storm, unlike Russia's bombardment, soon passes. Over the freshly dug row of graves that advance into no man's land on the edge of town. In this deadly standoff, it is the only front line that's moving forward.
Just wrenching. That was John Ray with Independent Television News. Now, let's look at questions around monkeypox, a rare illness that has been found in a number of countries around the world, including the U.S. In light of the coronavirus pandemic, many are asking questions about what they need to know. John Yang gets some answers.
Judy, worldwide, there have been roughly 200 confirmed and suspected cases in at least a dozen countries. In the United States, the first case was identified last week in a Massachusetts patient who had recently been in Canada. There is a small number of presumed, though not yet confirmed, cases in New York City, Florida, and Utah. Dr. Peter Hotez is dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. Dr. Hotez, thanks so much for being with us. Let's start off with the basics. What is monkeypox? What are its symptoms, and how is it transmitted? How is it spread?
Well, monkeypox belongs to a family of viruses known as orthopox viruses, actually similar to smallpox, but much less severe in terms of human disease. It's transmitted by close physical contact or through droplets or potentially respiratory contact, usually intimate contact, produces less severe disease than smallpox. It begins with fever, backache, headache, and then one of the distinguishing features is lots of swollen lymph nodes, particularly around the head and neck, but also elsewhere in the body. And then a day or two later, it's associated with a characteristic rash. So first a vesicular rash similar to chickenpox, and then it becomes pustules after that.
You say close contact and droplets. It sounds a little bit like COVID.
Well, it's actually much more difficult to transmit than COVID. So COVID is an aerosolized virus. You can have some degree of aerosolization with monkeypox, but it's primarily through very close, intimate, face-to-face contact. So in this case, we're seeing higher rates of infection among gay and bisexual men, but not through sexual transmission, we don't think. Rather, it's that other intimate skin-to-skin or other intimate contact, but not through conventional sexual transmission.
What else do we know about this outbreak, and how concerned should Americans be about it?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind the numbers. As you pointed out, around 200 cases. Now it's up to around 250 cases, about half of them in Spain and Portugal, both suspected and confirmed cases. Then the UK, we're talking about 20, 25 cases in Canada, four or five cases confirmed or suspected in the United States. Those numbers will grow, but it's unlikely that we're going to be talking anything close to what we've seen with COVID-19. And there's a lot of good news to think about. One is it's not nearly as transmissible. You have a much longer incubation period, maybe up to 2 weeks. That gives you time to investigate the contacts. You can trace the contacts because if you have the infection, you have a characteristic vesicular or pustular rash. And because the vaccines and drugs used to treat or prevent smallpox also cross-protect or treat monkeypox, the U.S. government for the last 20 years since the founding of BARDA has been stockpiling vaccines for smallpox and antiviral drugs. So if the numbers do start to increase and we have to vaccinate populations at risk, we can move on that pretty quickly. So for all of those reasons, we're not looking at anything near the magnitude or the concern of something like COVID-19.
How unusual is this outbreak, though? It's not usually seen in the United States.
That's right. I think the unusual piece to this is the fact that it's been, you have multiple foci in European countries, particularly in Southern Europe and the UK, but also in Germany and Belgium and elsewhere, and now North America. I think that's the really striking part. And just by coincidence, it probably became an individual in the gay or bisexual community, became infected, and then, according to the World Health Organization, potentially passed it on through sexual networks, and that seems to be where it's spreading. But, you know, we don't have a lot of detail, so it's not as if those 250 cases, we've seen publicly the demographics of those individuals. We're hearing that it's among predominantly men 20 to 50 years of age, but we don't know that for certain. So the unknown is whether we'll see secondary transmission in European and North American countries after that. And that's really important. And it's really critical that we be very careful how we talk about this disease to avoid any type of social stigma. This is an infectious disease that can be managed, can be treated, and can be prevented, whether or not the U.S. government decides to deploy the smallpox vaccine and which one they'll use, because one of them that we have is a non-replicating virus. And if you're concerned about its use in individuals who are HIV positive, that might be the preferable vaccine, although we only have about 1,000 doses of that one stockpiled, as opposed to the tens of millions of the older, more conventional smallpox vaccine.
Dr. Peter Hotez from the Baylor College of Medicine, thank you very much.
Thank you.
A new report documents in devastating detail how the past leadership of the Southern Baptist Convention ignored sexual abuse allegations for the better part of two decades and sometimes silenced or tried to discredit accusers. Amna Nawaz has more on the details of this disturbing report and the challenges it poses.
Judy, the Southern Baptist Convention is the largest Protestant denomination in the U.S., with about 14 million members across 47,000 churches. This independent report, over 200 pages long, examined hundreds of cases of sexual misconduct and abuse between 2000 and 2020. Among the findings, church leaders publicly fought calls to track ministers accused of abuse, even as they privately maintained a list hundreds of names long at one point. The report finds church leaders, quote, protected or even supported abusers for years. Joining us now is one of the survivors of church abuse, Anne Marie Miller. She is the author of Healing Together, a guide to supporting sexual abuse survivors, and a registered nurse in Dallas. Anne Marie, welcome to the NewsHour. Thank you for your time. Mm-hmm. I know you've had a chance to go through some of the report. I'm sure you have seen the headlines. What was your reaction? Did anything surprise you?
Honestly, nothing really surprised me about the report. I'm so glad that it's here. I'm so glad that tangible steps have finally occurred after decades of this. But reading the report, unfortunately, nothing was really a surprise.
We should mention you grew up in the Southern Baptist congregation. You were 16, as you have spoken publicly before, when your abuse by one of the church leaders began in the 1990s. And years went by before you reported it to church officials. What happened after that? What was the response?
The response after I reported it was, initially, it seemed like a good thing, like people were caring for me, but the actual organization ended up not reporting it to authorities and allowing the person that abused me to continue going up the ladder in the Southern Baptist Convention. So he was a high-ranking executive when he was finally arrested in 2018.
What was that like for you at the time to see that happen?
It was almost as traumatizing as the abuse itself.
And what about from the congregation? Did you get any response from them?
I actually had left the church at that point because I did not feel safe in the church, and I was really wrestling with my faith at that time.
It did take you years after that as well. You eventually went to the police, right, when church officials didn't do anything about it. What happened after that?
I went to the police thinking they weren't going to do anything because it had been 20 plus years since it had happened. But within 24 hours, they were investigating it, and he was arrested and eventually indicted for 4 sex abuse felonies. At that point, there was a large reckoning happening within the Southern Baptist Convention. A lot of abuse stories had come public. And I believe that it was kind of that moment that this task force and other investigations started to become finally necessary, because the media was finally pushing these stories forward, so they had to do something to address it.
Anne Marie, when you were younger, did you know of other people who had been abused? Were these kinds of stories known within the church?
They weren't. I grew up in small towns in West Texas, but I think they were probably happening. It's just not something you talk about in the church. You don't talk about sex in general. And so if you're abused, like with my own abuse, I didn't feel like I could talk about it because I didn't see it as abuse at the time, but I felt as if I was sinning and I needed to protect this man of God who was abusing me, because it would look bad on God. It would look bad on the church. There was sin involved. There was so much shame involved in it that, especially with kids, I mean, and adults, you just don't know how to deal with that in such a religious environment.
There are details in this report, like how church leaders talked about survivors like you, how disparaging they were, how hard they worked to silence people like you. What was that like for you to read?
It's hard to see names that you are familiar with that are supposedly leading people to Christ, caring for others, showing compassion for the poor, and at the same time calling survivors satanic. And just say, sometimes people would receive death threats from leaders within the Southern Baptist Church. I wasn't, but I have friends that received death threats from pastors within the convention. And that's just beyond comprehensible to me.
You know, we should note that unlike the Catholic Church, which has grappled with similar issues, there's no top-down hierarchy in the Southern Baptist Convention. Does that, to your mind, does that make accountability harder?
It does. It's something I always called the idol of autonomy, and it's kind of just a way for churches to escape, you know, liability, or really for the whole organization. Because if you have something happen in this little church, then you can't sue the entire organization. They're not responsible. It's like, oh, that's their thing. They need to deal with it. We can't do anything else about it. And they dodge accountability.
So what would you like to see happen now? Now, these hundreds of pages are out there. It's an independent report. There's some shocking revelations in here. What should happen next?
I think that the everyday person that goes to Southern Baptist churches need to really consider where they're spending their money and where they're going, and see that there are tons of survivors that need care and compassion, and know that this is true. This is objective documentation. It's not made up. So believe survivors and care for them.
So we should mention church executive committee leaders said they're committed to doing all they can to prevent future instances of sexual abuse in churches. Do you believe that they will?
I guess we'll have to see. I don't know how to answer that question. I hope that they will, but we're going to need to see it, and we need a lot more than thoughts and prayers. We need tangible action.
That is Anne Marie Miller joining us tonight from Dallas. Anne Marie, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
The annual Profile in Courage Award ceremony took place last night at the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library in Boston. This year, the Kennedy family honored Democrats and Republicans for upholding election integrity and the president of Ukraine. I was there for a most inspiring night. The John F. Kennedy Library Foundation honored five people with the Profile in Courage Award for their commitment to protecting democracy in the U.S. and around the globe. The first honoree, Shay Moss, was an election office worker in Fulton County, Georgia. She withstood relentless harassment and even death threats during and ever since the 2020 presidential election.
Ever since December 2020, my family has been under attack. Attacked because people have spread terrible lies. I'm sorry. Lies about me and my mother simply because we were doing our jobs, doing the work our democracy requires day in and day out. My mom and I have both heard the worst kinds of threats and harassments. Many of those were just openly racist. I want to give a special thank you to all the anonymous election workers out there, the ones that are doing the heavy lifting our democracy depends on, far from the spotlights.
Two other U.S. officials were also honored for defending and protecting election results, Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, a Democrat, and Arizona State House Speaker Rusty Bowers, a Republican. In the face of nonstop attacks from her own party, Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney was honored for her courage in standing against calls to overturn the 2020 election.
President Kennedy said, "In the long history of freedom, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. Today, that role is ours. As we face a threat we have never faced before, a former president attempting to unravel our constitutional republic. At this moment, we must all summon the courage to stand against that. The question for every one of us is, in this time of testing, will we do our duty? Will we defend our Constitution? Will we stand for truth? Will we put duty to our oath above partisan politics? Or will we look away from danger, ignore the threat, embrace the lies, and enable the liar?"
The final award of the night went to Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky for his leadership and bravery in defending his country against Russia's invasion. A Ukrainian diplomat accepted on his behalf. And that diplomat, Yaroslav Brisuk, drew applause when he noted that Vladimir Putin had originally bragged he was sending the world's second-best army into the war. But it ended up, he said, that it was only the second-best army in Ukraine. And on the NewsHour online right now, New Orleans is giving young people a guaranteed income of $350 a month, hoping to break the cycle of poverty. You can read more about the city's plan at PBS.org/NewsHour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.